Oh, good morning.
If you look up the screen up there, so one thing I'm starting new this year is during the message or after the message today, as you maybe are thinking about the message or a thought pops in your head, if you have a question that you would love to ask that you didn't get a chance to, let's say in the sermon, to raise your hand and ask it, we set up an email address, sermonquestions@arborheights.org. And what is, if you want to send a question to that during the week, I will do my best to try and answer that. And then we're going to post it on our blog on our website. We have a blog up there, and we want to make sure we can figure out how best to utilize that blog. And I just thought it'd be a great way for us to connect. And if you've got questions, I'd love to do my best to try and answer them. So we'll try and put the email address up on the website too. So if you go and you want to post something, then it's up there. But sermonquestions@arborheights.org. All right, have you ever expected something and it turned out totally different? I think we all would say yes. Yeah, well, about 11 years ago, when my wife was pregnant and we were about to have our first child, it's your first child, right? So this is, your expectations are huge about this. And you, most parents have expectations about the birth and how the birth is going to go. And my wife and I certainly had those. Well, one of the things she had discussed with me as we got closer to that date was how she thought it might be wise to have her mother in the room, considering that me around things that are medical, let's call it, you know, blood or that sort of thing, I usually don't do well. And she said it might be wise to have my mother in the room, which I responded, no, we're not doing that. I want this to be just you and me going through it, and I do not want that. And she's like, okay, so we'll just stick with you and me. All right, so we get there to the hospital about 11 years ago. We're getting all ready. Everything is going. My wife is in there pushing. It was really quick, actually. And right about the time that the birth was going to happen, I'm standing up beside her. The room just starts spinning. It's spinning, stars are going all, you know, around. I'm like, oh no, and I scream out. I'm like, I'm going down. And this nurse yells out my, she's like, we have a dropper. And this other nurse has a chair with rollers. She flings it to me, it hits in the back of my legs, and I drop into this chair. It was like they had this all planned out, like they'd done this before, you know? And I'm laying in this chair, and she's like, get your head between your legs. And so I stick my head between my legs, and I'm down there, and it's still just blackness, you know. And I mean, I'm on the verge of passing out. And she yells, get him some juice. And so they bring me this huge, big carton of juice, and they give it to me. So I'm down here drinking my juice, and my head's between my legs. And then I start feeling a little bit better. So then I hop up, and as soon as I hop up, I'm like, oh, no. And I go back down. And I'm down again, and I was like, oh, this is horrible, you know, and I'm groaning and stuff like that. And then finally, I'm drinking all this juice, and I start feeling better. And so I was like, okay, and so I look up, and there's our daughter on my wife's chest. And I was like, I missed it. I missed the whole birth. And later, I, you know, talk to my wife, and she's like, what happened to you? And she's like, you know, the nurses are running around. And I said, yeah. I said, honey, it was awful. And she's like, awful? I'm giving birth. She's like, I completely forgot about you. I'm like, forget this guy. I got to get this baby out. So our birth did not go as expected, though. So. But, you know, how about when you talk to someone on the phone and you, like all of us, get a mental picture of that person, right? And then you meet them in person. You ever had that? And you're like, oh, not what I expected, right? Or maybe when you expect to lay your head down on your pillow at night and feel a nice, soft, fluffy, cushioned pillow, but you feel something really hard. You look then below your pillow, and you find a couple of frozen ice packs put there by your younger daughter, which happened to me last week. As I crawl into bed, I'm like, what's so hard under the pillow? And I look, and there's two ice packs. And I see her in the morning, and she giggles and told me she put them under there. So not what I expected. Well, you know what? As I've been looking through the Bible and reading through the Gospels especially, one of the things that just pops out is how often Jesus breaks our expectations of who he is. Over and over and over again, people have these expectations of who Jesus is, how Jesus should work, what Jesus should do, and Jesus smashes them. He smashes their expectations. And so what we're going to do is we're starting a brand new series today, Jesus Unexpected, Out of the Box Living. And we're going to look at five or six different stories of Jesus in the Gospels. And now he breaks our expectations. He defies our expectations to show us the deeper truth about himself and us. We're going to look today at the story of Lazarus and Mary and Martha in John 11. And so I'm going to read that story. We don't have it up in the PowerPoint. It's way too long. And so if you have a Bible with you, you can open to John chapter 11, or there's a Bible in the pew if you want to as well. But John chapter 11, verses 1 through 44. And I'm going to go ahead and read through the whole story. And then we're going to come back and basically kind of take a hike through this passage and pull off at a couple sections and talk about some things. All right, so John chapter 11, verses 1 through 44. It says, "Now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, 'Lord, the one you love is sick.' When he heard this, Jesus said, 'This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it.' Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Yet, when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. Then he said to his disciples, 'Let us go back to Judea.'" He was on one side of the Jordan River, and now he's talking about going back. "But Rabbi," they said, "a short while ago, the Jews tried to stone you, and yet you're going back there." Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours of daylight? A man who walks by day will not stumble, for he sees by this world's light. It is when he walks by night that he stumbles, for he has no light." After he has said this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to wake him up." His disciples replied, "Lord, if he sleeps, he will get better." Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So then he told them plainly, "Lazarus is dead." I can just see Jesus. Guys, what in the world? Pull it together. "He's dead. And for your sake, I am glad I was not there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him." Then Thomas, called Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, "Let us also go, that we may die with him." A courageous plea by Thomas. Verse 17, on his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha answered, "I know he will rise again, the resurrection at the last day." Jesus replied to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" "Yes, Lord," she told him. "I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who was to come into the world." And after she said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. "The teacher's here," she said, "and is asking for you." When Mary heard this, she got up and quickly went to him. Now Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house comforting her noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." When Jesus saw her weeping and the Jews who'd come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. "Where have you laid him?" he asked. "Come and see, Lord," they replied. Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, "See how we loved him?" But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying?" Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there is a bad odor, for he has been there 4 days." Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. Then Jesus looked up and said, "Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me." When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out!" The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and cloth around his face. Jesus said to them, "Take off the clothes and let him go." All right, amazing story about Lazarus being raised from the dead. So what we're going to do is I'm going to start back at the beginning of that, and we're just going to, like I said, kind of take a hike through this passage. And like you're going on a hike, there's going to be points where you stop, and we're going to pull off the path for a minute and talk about what we're seeing and kind of observe it and talk about the ways that Jesus is breaking a lot of expectations in this whole story, and then we'll hop back on the path at certain points, okay? So let's start back at the beginning, right there in the first couple of verses. It's important to point out that this Martha and Mary and Lazarus were not people that Jesus had just met once. We learn in the other Gospels and other parts of the Gospels that Jesus, oftentimes when he would go into Jerusalem, he would stay at their house. So he knew them very well. He had known them over a number of months, and he was very close to them, close friends to Lazarus. And so this wasn't just strangers that we're talking about. These are close friends who he knows. Well, not long after that, you see in verse 3 that Lazarus, the brother, has gotten sick. And so in verse 3, the sisters send word to Jesus, Lord, the one you love is sick. And it's important to note, this doesn't mean sick like Lazarus is suffering from a bad sinus infection. Please come, he's got a bad cold. This is like he's on his deathbed sickness. This is like he doesn't have much probably left to go. And it would be great if you could come soon to see him. That's the kind of sickness we're talking about here. Well, in verse 4, Jesus says a very interesting thing. He says, this sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory so that God's Son may be glorified through it. It's interesting, Jesus interprets and sees the sickness in a very different manner than they do. He points out here that he sees it not so much as an issue with sickness, but as an issue to display God's glory. And we'll have a chance later to talk about that. But he sees it in a very different light. So when Jesus gets this news, Jesus quickly packs up his bag and heads out, right? No, it says that Jesus, in fact, stayed two more days. In verse 5, and we'll talk about it in a minute, in verse 5, John makes a very interesting comment, too. He says, Jesus loved Martha and her sister Lazarus. It's kind of an interesting statement to make in this whole entire story. This is one verse that says that he loved them very much. And I think the reason why is because of the very next verse. In verse 6, it says, yet when he had heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was two more days. I think talking about here, Jesus is loving them. And then it says yet, so a word that's a contrasting word, saying he loved them, but yet he did something different. He did something different. He decided to stay two more days. He is communicating his love for them, but we would say, I think, very obviously, it looks as though he does something that's unloving. He says he's loving, but does something unloving. And this, I think, is the first opportunity to pull off the path for a second. Just, can you imagine for a second if this happened to you? Can you imagine if you got a phone call from a relative, a close relative, or a close friend or someone you knew, and they said so-and-so is basically dying, and you said, you know, that's really sad, and I'm going to go ahead and stay here. I mean, can you actually imagine saying that? Can you imagine doing that? I think if any of us did that, would you not be perceived as someone who's calloused, as someone who's probably selfish, as someone who's probably not sensitive of others, right? I think we all would. That certainly is the conclusion that I would come to. If I had a close friend dying and I asked someone to come who was close to them and they said no, and they came 2 days later. So what's going on here? What's happening? And a couple things is this. First, I think it's crucial to point out that in that verse 5, John wants us to know very clearly Jesus loved them. Jesus loved Mary and Martha and Lazarus. Jesus was for them and not against them. Jesus was pursuing them. Jesus was after them. Jesus was there for him. Jesus was sacrificing for them. Jesus loved them. No matter what the exterior looked like in Martha's life and in Mary's life, and no matter what's happening all around them with this whole circumstance of their brother, Jesus wanted them to know very clearly, I love you. I love you in the midst of this. He is the good shepherd, Jesus says, that lays down his life for the sheep. Do you think that Jesus' actions did not appear unloving to Mary and Martha? I think they certainly did feel unloving. Do you think Jesus didn't know that his actions would come off as unloving? Of course not. I think Jesus absolutely knew his actions were going to come off as unloving, that he was going to be insensitive. He knew that. And it raises the question, have you ever experienced that? Have you ever experienced someone do something in your life or say something in your life that at the time being did not seem loving, but yet later on in your life, you realized, in fact, it was loving. It was, in fact, one of the most loving things that they could do for you. I think if you're a parent, you see this a lot. In fact, my wife and I talk about, I feel like three-fourths of our parenting basically comes down to this. Actions and words done to our kids, which are interpreted as unloving, and yet in reality are loving. Just one example is a couple weeks ago, we went to get our Santa pictures. So every year as a family, since our kids have been born, we go to the mall and we get our Santa pictures, and then we put them up in our house, then you can see the progression of the kids over the years. It's really cool. Something we've done for a long time. Well, we get ready to go, and my oldest daughter, who's on the brink of turning 11, this is the first year where she said, "Why do we have to go? This is so dumb. I mean, why do we got to go and be with Santa? This is so kiddish. This is what babies do. This is what toddlers do. 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds don't do this kind of stuff. This is baby stuff." And my wife and I were like, "Listen, honey, when you get the picture, when you see it, and think about 20 years now, when you're 30 and you look back, you're going to love this picture. It's going to be so great." She's like, "It's going to be stupid." And so we get in the car and we go, and the whole car right there is just constant whining. "This is so dumb. I can't know why we're going." And then we get there, and the best thing was we get in line with my younger daughter, and they get close to Santa, and they see him, and she looks over at me, and she's like, "I'm not sitting on his lap." And then the lady, like, literally the perfect timing, the worker comes, she's like, "Okay, so who's sitting on Santa's lap?" And my sister's like, "She is, the younger sister. She's sitting on his lap. I'm not doing that. 11-year-olds don't sit on Santa's lap." And so we got the picture, or we did the picture, and then they print it out, like, right then for you. And we go over and we open it up. And I'm like, "Look, honey, isn't this great? It's a great thing you're going to have." And she's like, "This is stupid." And we are like, "Oh, great." And so we walk out of there, and so I'm sure you guys, if other parents have experienced that. But you know, it was something that in 20 years now, she'll look back and she'll be like, "Oh, those are so cute to see our pictures of us," and she'll love those. And of course, it was very loving of us to do that. But it was not interpreted as loving. You know, Jesus will either cause, allow, or engineer things in your life that feel harsh, that feel hurtful, that are absent, and even feel like you've been abandoned. But he loves you. He loves you. You know, unfortunately, though, this is one of the times in a Christian's life when people stop following God. It's when the time when I thought you were loving and you're supposed to be loving, but something happens in my life which doesn't feel like a loving God. And it's at this point where some people begin to make a journey not towards Jesus, but away from Jesus. It's when we get anger, we have resentment, sometimes even deep hatred. We wind up lashing out at other people because we're so mad at God. Or sometimes for some of us, we just have a quiet, subtle despair that sits into our hearts. We'll talk about this a little bit later to unpack it a little bit more, but I do want to encourage us and to learn from Martha and even Mary that bottom line is we need to trust God's character over our circumstances. We trust God's character over our circumstances. But it begs the question, why does Jesus do this? Why does Jesus do things that appear unloving, that appear he isn't there? And to be honest, I mean, I could do 6 sermons about this, about all the ways that God does that. But I do want to just talk about a couple of the reasons why and a couple things behind it. First off, I think that Jesus sees life through a very different lens than we do. And I think you see this very clearly in this passage, right? Right at the very beginning, in verse 4, when Jesus finds out about the sickness of Lazarus, everyone is concerned about this sickness, right? What's Jesus' response? Jesus' response in verse 4 is, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Jesus didn't see an issue of sickness. Jesus saw an issue to put God's glory on display. That's what Jesus saw. That's what Jesus was concerned about. It's interesting because just 2 chapters earlier in John chapter 9 at the beginning, there's this part where Jesus and his disciples are walking around and they encounter this man who's born blind. And in that culture, the disciples make the assumption that this man or his parents must have sinned, and that's why he's blind. And so they say to Jesus, who sinned, this man or his parents? And Jesus says, neither of them sinned. Jesus said, this happened in his life so that the work of God might be displayed. Again, it wasn't about this man's blindness. It was about God's glory being put on display. And even a little bit later on in this passage, verse 15, if you remember that part when the disciples are like, hey, if he sleeps, he's going to get better. And Jesus is like, you idiots, I'm not talking about sleep. I'm talking about that he's dead, and I'm going to bring him back to life. And Jesus says that kind of powerful phrase, that I'm glad I wasn't there. I'm glad I wasn't there to help this guy so that you might what? You might believe in me. For Jesus, it was about believing in him. It wasn't about this guy's health. As hard as that is to swallow, that Jesus clearly saw things through a very different lens. And he sees things very differently than you and I do. A couple examples of this is that he cares more about our character than our comfort. We, on the other hand, care more about our comfort than our character. Hence, the reason why we create and develop expectations for Jesus to help and organize and orchestrate our lives to be more comfortable. And hence, the clash of our expectations. The second one, Jesus cares more about our holiness than our happiness. We, on the other hand, care more about our happiness than our holiness. Hence, the development of expectations for Jesus to support that and encourage our happiness. And again, expectations clashing. The thing is with Jesus is that in his love and his goodness and his graciousness for us, he will not shrink down to accommodate these things. He will not shrink down to accommodate our desires for comfort or our desires for happiness. He won't do it. Why? Not because he hates us, because he loves us. Because he's so good and he's so gracious, he won't give that to us because he knows that's not what you need. He knows we need him. And hence then why we oftentimes interpret the things that happen in our life as unloving from him or uncaring for him or insensitive. The third one is this, and I highlighted or mentioned it just a little bit earlier, is that Jesus allows us to walk through these things because he wants us to develop character faith versus circumstantial faith. Or I could say expectation faith. He wants us to have character faith, not circumstantial faith. When Jesus defies our expectations, he wants us to trust his character over our circumstances. When we go through times like what Martha and Mary went through, do we not discover that oftentimes our faith is in something other than God, right? Have not almost all of us gone through this? When you walk through something and you realize that perhaps your faith was not really in Jesus, it was in your circumstances or it was in your expectations of God or what you wanted from God, not God himself. And that is circumstantial faith or expectation faith. But what does God do? God always draws us into trusting and relying on him alone. That's what he always does. He's always orchestrating, engineering everything in our lives so that we would trust in him alone. Cannot all of us think about things we've gone through, struggles we've gone through, difficulties, all that kind of stuff? And the whole time I began to see inside of me and began to realize the ways that I did not depend on God. And if you're like me, oftentimes we say we trust in God, right? We say it with our mouths and maybe believe it in our heads, but when you look at our lives and the way we actually function, we don't. We don't. We went up trusting in other things, and it takes these difficulties to reveal that to us. To begin to realize those things, that in fact our dependence is on things like our abilities or our bank accounts or other people or expectations of God, like I said, or our own performance or our circumstances. So when God takes us through these times, we perceive his actions as unloving and uncaring. Yet like Martha and like Mary and like Lazarus, as he brings us through the losses, we go through the struggles, we go through the disappointments and the unmet expectations, it is actually the most loving thing he could do. Now, I say this recognizing that as you're maybe walking through that right now, that doesn't sound very loving. That doesn't sound comforting. In fact, that may sound callous to you. That may sound, well, that's great in theology, that's great in the Bible, but in reality, that's not how I feel. being that the case, I think it's really important to think about and remember a little bit later on in chapter 11, verses 33 through 35. So here Jesus is coming 2 days later after what Martha and Mary wanted him to, completely crushing their expectations. And in verse 33, he says, "When Jesus saw her weeping, Mary, and the Jews who had come along with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in spirit and troubled and said, 'Where have you laid him?' 'Come and see, Lord,' they replied." And then the shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. Jesus wept. You know, scholars debate as to what was the reason for Jesus weeping, and there's different thoughts on that as to why he was weeping. But I think from the context, there's two things. I think one, clearly he was moved, I think, by the grief of the people around him. No matter that Jesus knew he'd raised Lazarus from the dead, Jesus knew who he was, the reality is Jesus had compassion, and he was broken over people who were grieving. I think Jesus also was grieved over the reality of death, that he saw the results of death and what death did, and he knew death was never a part of his design. And so that brought him to tears as well. But bottom line, Jesus could speak the truth of who he is and the truth of breaking people's expectations, and on the other hand, he'd weep with them because he understands what it's like to have a God who seems absent and not there and unloving. And the last thing is that Jesus doesn't meet our expectations because he lives according to what the Father says, not what other people think. This passage is so filled with other people's expectations of what Jesus should do and how he should act and how he should function, all this stuff. And the whole time, Jesus does not make decisions based on people's expectations, but on the Father's will. Over and over and over again. You see that in Jesus' life in the Gospels. It's always the Father's timeline, always the Father's plans, always the Father's will, and he never accommodates to people's expectations. He never does that. How much of your decisions in life are being made by other people or made by you to meet other people's expectations? I think some of us, if we're honest right now, would have to admit that we're not really sure what God wants for us to do with our lives. We're not sure what to do with our lives, or we're not sure where God's directing our lives or where he's leading us at all. In fact, a lot of our decisions, if we're honest, are made by people around us, or they're made by us to impress people around us. Right? I think a lot of us would have to admit that. That our lives are being directed ultimately by decisions of other people and the influence of them and the expectations of them, spouses, kids, friends, coworkers, books, blogs, whatever it is, determining that. And Jesus over and over again teaches us that he does not do that. The question would be, why did Jesus say when they told him to come that it was about God's glory, and why did he say he'd be 2 days late? Where did he get that from? I would argue he got that because he was in communion with the Father. That's why he did that. It's because God told him, don't go. That's why he didn't go. So he waited to hear what God wanted, not what other people wanted, and then he responded accordingly, and he obeyed it and did it, what God told him to go do. He lives for God's expectations, not his. Okay, now let's get back on the road. So I'm going to talk about that part. We're going to hop back out on our path, and I want to bypass a little bit of the next part where Jesus talks to his disciples about he's going back to Judea and all that, and pick up in the part where in verse 17, it says, "On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother." You know what's interesting? When I read that, that verse really popped out. You know why I think? I think John put that there to show us the contrast. Here are all these Jewish people who are doing what I think most of, if not all of us, would say is the right thing. It says they came down to comfort Martha and Mary in the loss of their brother. Interestingly, who didn't come? Jesus. And I think John wants us to see that, that all these people came to comfort them. Jesus didn't. Again, kind of building up these expectations that get broken down. And then in verse 21, Martha says, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." And again, I want to pull off on this. "Lord, if you would have been here, my brother would not have died." That statement is pregnant with expectations. Lots of expectations. If basically saying, if you would have just done the thing that I wanted you to do, you've just done the thing I thought you would do, if you had just done the thing I would have expected you to do, this wouldn't have happened. I wouldn't be in the place that I'm in, and my brother would still be alive if you had just done what I expected you to do. I think what Martha says here is what many of us have either said out loud to God or in the quietness of our hearts. If you would have been here, blank, and you fill in your blank, wouldn't have happened. If you would have been here, this would have never happened. I think the truth is this is another crossroads where many people choose to stop following Jesus. It's when I needed you the most, Jesus, that you weren't there. You experienced that? It's when I needed you the most that you weren't there. Think of the disappointment. Think of the anger. Think of the hurt. Think of the abandonment which Martha and Mary must have felt. These weren't strangers. These were close friends. I asked you to come. The horrible time in my life, my brother's dying, and you don't come? How could you do this? You know, some of us, I think, have walked away publicly from Christ, and it's reflected in our life. Our life reflects it very clearly, walking away from Christ. I think from others of us, though, we walk away privately and quietly. We continue to go through the outer activities of what a Christian should do, all the things that are somewhat expected of a Christian, and yet quietly inside, we no longer walk with Jesus in that part of our life. We think about Jesus didn't help me. Jesus didn't rescue me. You didn't save me. You weren't there for me when I needed you the most. You know, in John, a little bit earlier in his book, John 6, verse 66 is when Jesus gives us really hard teaching about himself to his disciples. And all of a sudden, a bunch of disciples leave. And Jesus looks at the disciples and he says, "Are you going to leave too?" And he says, did what I say offend you? And it's almost like this point blank, like Jesus in your face, almost like in your face, I didn't show up for you. What are you going to do about it? And Peter has this response, and his response is, where else are we going to go? What else am I going to do? I know if I go to the world, it has nothing to offer me. I know it's bankrupt and it's empty and it's meaningless. And yet I go to you and you're not who I expect. You're not there when I wanted you to be there. Where do I go? But Peter knows you're the only place for me to go to. The only place for me to go to. And it's really interesting what you find with Martha and what she does with that. If you weren't here, this would have happened. Well, in the second part of that passage, she says, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now, God will give you whatever you ask. I think you see Martha do two things with this. First, you see she goes to Jesus with her hurt. She goes to Jesus with her hurt. When this happens, oftentimes we're so quick to turn our faces this way from Jesus. What she does with her hurt is she turns to Jesus. And she said, I'd rather go through my hurt with you than without you. I'd rather go through it with you than without you. It's really interesting, too, because in her statement in that second part, but I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. It's interesting to note what she didn't say. She didn't say after she said, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Therefore, that's why I hate you. That's why you're not welcome in my life anymore. That's why I don't trust you anymore. But she turns and said, I'm going to come to you with it. I'm going to come to you with my hurt and with my pain. The second thing I think she does is she chooses faith in Jesus' character over her circumstances. I said that statement earlier. She chooses to have faith in Jesus' character over her circumstances. She says to him, but I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. No, do you hear the faith there? Do you hear the faith there? It's this belief that even if what you've done doesn't match up to what I thought you would do, and what I expected you to do. I trust you. I trust you. And this is so huge for a Christian. This is so fundamental as a follower of Christ to settle this in your heart and to get this, that we have got to be people that put our trust in Jesus' character over our circumstances. I can't tell you how many times that we put our faith in circumstances, not in God's character, and then we conclude from our circumstances who God is. It's the other way around. You put your faith in God and who He is, and then you interpret your circumstances. Then you understand what's happening in your life. Not the other way around. It makes you think about a pilot and a pilot flying. Did you know there's basically two ways a pilot flies, right? A pilot flies with his instruments or the weather. And a pilot is flying, and if he's not using instruments, he's looking at the weather and gauging how he flies from the weather. So it's sunny, and I can see, and I can determine where I'm going and what's going on. I can see the spot where I need to land and all that. But what does he do when he doesn't have the visibility of how to fly or where to go, when it's a total whiteout, let's say? He flies solely by the instruments. That means he's looking at devices in the plane, and he's completely trusting them and making decisions about all the passengers' lives based off of this, not off what he can see. Not off of what he can see. He literally is not even looking around at what's going on. He's looking at what the instrument's telling him to do and then flying according to that. It's the exact same thing. We've got to have instrument faith, not weather faith. Instrument faith, not weather faith. We base who God is off of his character and we act accordingly. If you don't do that, your plane, if it hasn't yet, is going to crash. It will crash and crash hard because circumstances will let you down in life. Your expectations of Jesus will come crashing down unless you cling to who he is and his character. A couple passages in the Bible that really speak to this truth. In Job, you know, if not the most top person in the Bible who suffers the most, Job, he says in chapter 13, verse 15 of his book, "Though he slay me, yet will I hope in him. Though he slay me, yet will I hope in him." And in Habakkuk 3:17 through 18, Habakkuk looks around him and what's happening in his country, and there's violence everywhere, and nothing's being done about it. And Habakkuk goes to God and says, "What in the world's going on? I thought you were a good God. I thought you were a just God. I thought you were God who cared about justice in people's lives, and I look around and you're doing nothing." And God comes and God speaks to him. At the end of his book, Habakkuk ends it with this: "Though the fig tree does not bud, and there are no grapes on the vines, though the olive crop fails and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen and no cattle in the stalls," basically, I look around me and there's no evidence of you anywhere. Nothing in my life says you're here. "Yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in God my Savior." I don't care if everything around me is falling down. You are faithful. You are good. You are loving, and you will be there for me. I don't care what it looks like. That is the kind of faith we need. That is rock solid faith. Martha chooses to go through her broken expectations with Jesus and to trust him despite her circumstances. What's interesting, though, is the next verse, verse 23, where she says that, and then Jesus responds and says to her, "Your brother will rise again." Your brother will rise again. Again, I think what's so interesting is what Jesus doesn't say. Notice what Jesus doesn't do. Jesus doesn't explain why he's late. Do you know that? You know, in this whole entire passage, Jesus never once explains to Mary and Martha why he was late. We get the glimpse at the beginning of it because John records it, because it's done for God's glory in that. But throughout the whole passage, Jesus never once says to them, "Hey guys, here's why I was late." Wouldn't all of us be asking that? Wouldn't that be our first question, right? When your friend showed up 2 days late and the person died, wouldn't the first question out of your mouth be, "Where in the world were you? What the heck happened?" Jesus doesn't answer that. He never once says anything about explaining it. Jesus doesn't explain himself. He reveals himself. He doesn't explain himself. He reveals himself. Martha and Mary wanted an explanation for what happened. Jesus pointed them to himself. In essence, he was saying, I think, something like this: Martha, I am enough. I am everything that matters and what your heart is truly searching for. I won't give you explanations because I love you too much. What you need isn't answers, Martha. What you need is me. I think Jesus essentially gives her math, and he gives every one of us math when it comes to these things. Jesus gives us math. He gives us me plus nothing equals everything. Martha, me plus nothing equals everything. You know what the truth, though, is that some of us don't want to hear that. Some of us don't want to hear, you're with me. Some of us want to hear an explanation. Some of us want answers for our past. We want answers for our hurts. We want answers for our pain. I want an answer for my loss. Some of us have been waiting and waiting and waiting and wanting for years for him to give you an answer. For what happened or why it happened or this or that or whatever it might be. And we hold on, I think, sometimes with this tight fist in our lives that you owe me an answer. You owe me a reason for what happened. You owe me, Jesus, to explain the 2 days that you were absent. You owe it to explain to me why you weren't here. And I think that more often than not, can he give you an answer? Sure. Might he give you an answer? Sure. But I think when I look at the Bible and my own experience and most people I've talked to, it's rare. He rarely gives people answers. I think rather he will point you to himself and invite you to trust in him with all of your heart. What he asks isn't easy, but it's what we need. You know, and I think it too, I thought about this, I think it's important if that's you, if you've been doing that for years and holding on for him to give you an answer, I think you need to hear something today. And what I want you to hear is that path that you're going down, that path, if you're holding on to that answer, if that's what you choose to do, I pray you don't. I pray you do let go, and I pray you do let Jesus heal you and Jesus point you to himself. But if you choose that you choose a path that when you end your life, you will be confronted with a regret so deep and expansive, you'll sob for days. When Jesus touches your heart and he opens your eyes and he shows you what your life would have looked like if you would have let go of that and let him heal that and transform it, you'll be filled with so much remorse you won't even be able to speak it. And so I want to encourage you today, and I'm not, you know, I don't know all of our journeys. I, of course, don't. And some of us have been on much horrible journeys that I could ever imagine. But I want to plead with you and encourage you today that in all of your hungering, he likely will never give you an answer. He will give you himself. And that's what you need. That's what you need. In verse 25 or 24, Martha says in response to him, I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Martha says, yes, I know he will rise. And he'll rise at the last day, just like all of us will rise, right? Martha's thinking about there's this event that's going to happen when we all die, and he's going to raise us back. Jesus looks at her and says, this is so awesome. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies, and whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? What a punch to the gut. What a Martha taking Jesus and putting him in a box like all of us do, and putting him in a box that he must fit these things, and Jesus taking that box and exploding it. Her looking at him with these expectations of, yeah, you know, I know someday that there's going to be a resurrection, and just looks in the face and says, Martha, I'm the resurrection. It's not an event. It's me. I am life standing in front of you. Can you believe that? You're standing there, and he's looking at you thinking, Martha, I have blown this to smithereens. You're standing before God himself. The resurrection is me. I am life as you know it. I'm the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I am it, Martha. I am it. And I imagine Martha must just have been like, oh my gosh, this is not what I imagined. This was not my expectations. I think Jesus defies her expectations so he can enlarge her frame. Enlarge her frame. I think what Jesus does with us is that we constantly have frames of Jesus. And we have a frame of who Jesus is and how Jesus should act and how he functions in my life and who I believe he is and how I relate to him. And we have a frame. And then what Jesus does is Jesus brings something in our life that we did not expect. Jesus brings something in our life that we didn't plan coming. And then in that, we suddenly discover a deeper thing about him, right? We discover a deeper truth, a bigger truth about who Jesus is. He expands our understanding and we think, wow, you're not who I thought you were. And then all of a sudden he gives us a bigger frame. A bigger frame, and we have a bigger picture of who Jesus is. And then we go on through life, and he keeps us at this frame, and his graciousness and love, he keeps us there because he loves us, but then again, he brings us through another thing. And that next thing, what's he doing? Enlarging our frame. He's going to take this frame, he's going to bring it down, and up will come even a bigger frame of him, and we'll discover even a greater depth of who Jesus is, how much bigger he is than whatever we thought. And that's what he's constantly doing. He's constantly enlarging our frame. And that's why he breaks our expectations. That's why he crushes them. That's why he won't meet our expectations, is he wants to keep enlarging our frames and expanding our frames. Notice, though, I was thinking about with Martha, with the frame enlargement he does with her, it's so cool because it's not academic, it's not knowledge, but it's an invitation or enlargement into greater intimacy with Christ. That's what the enlargement is. It's a bigger frame of walking deeper with Jesus, not knowing more about Jesus. And I think we constantly fall in this trap, that thinking that a deeper walk with Christ means deeper knowledge of Jesus. Yes, certainly it does, but you can know a lot about Jesus and not be close to Jesus. Right? So what he's doing is bringing you into this deeper relationship, this deeper intimacy. He wasn't looking when he told Martha that I'm the resurrection and the life. He wasn't looking for Martha to respond and say, wow, that's really interesting, Jesus. Thanks for sharing that with me. That's a really interesting insight. No, what's the last thing he asked her? Do you believe this? It's not academic, it's personal. Do you believe this? Will you surrender your life to this? Will you give your life up for this? Do you believe this is who I am, and will you walk in this way? It's a personal transformation, not gaining knowledge or academic things about Jesus. It's not academic, but personal. It's not theoretical, but relational. It's not theological, but surrendering. That's the real place of joy and peace and triumph. He wants to be our real rock. He wants to be our true refuge, and he wants to be our only rescue. But it only comes as we enlarge the frame of our picture of him, and he draws us deeper and deeper and deeper into who he is. The interesting thing about this, though, I told you before, is that when Jesus breaks our expectations, he doesn't just do it to show a deeper understanding of himself. He does it to show us a deeper understanding of ourselves. It's not just him, it's us. As he shows who he is, it's kind of weird, but it does show how much, it shows things deeper in our life. It's like a light that's shining on your life, and each time it's like Jesus turns the brightness of the light up just a little bit. And the more brighter it is, it shows more stuff in our lives, right? It shows all the warped parts and the broken parts and the dusty parts and all these dirty parts, right? And then next time, he shines a little bit brighter. And then it shows more, and he reveals more in our lives, right? And he does it in his graciousness and kindness only at the level that we're able to bear it. He doesn't flip the light all the way up to the brightest setting, right? So all of a sudden, our lives are just completely exposed. He slowly turns the light up, saying, there's something I want to show you about your life, another thing. And he graciously does it to us in his kindness, in his gentleness, and his love, and he reveals another place where we have an idol, another place where we're broken, another place where we trust in ourselves and not him. And he shows us it again and says, I love you, and I want to walk in this place with you. When we do this, I think that we discover that he is wilder than we ever imagined. He's more loving than we ever thought. He's more terrifying than you ever assumed. And he's holier than you ever thought possible. You know, my older daughter and I, about a year ago, finished the Chronicles of Narnia series. And some of you guys have read that, if not a lot of us. C.S. Lewis, one of my favorite authors. And my older daughter and I took like 4 years. And at night, we'd read through the Chronicles of Narnia, all 7 books. And the third book in the series called The Boy and His Horse. And we're reading that story together one night, my daughter and I. And we get to this section of the book, and the boy in the book, his name's Shasta. And Shasta has this experience in the book. And as my daughter and I were reading it, right in the middle of this description that C.S. was giving, I lost it. And I just started sobbing with my daughter there. And a lot of you guys know I'm a crier, so this probably doesn't come as a huge surprise. But my daughter's kind of looking at me like, what is wrong with Dad? You know, and I'm just like, and I'm crying. And I want to read you this part in the story, and then I want to tell you why I was crying. Okay, so this is out of that section of the book. This is Shasta's the boy, and I'll explain a little bit as he goes through. It says, "And being very tired and having nothing inside him, Shasta felt so sorry for himself that tears rolled down his cheeks. What put a stop to all of this was a sudden fright. Shasta discovered that someone or somebody was walking beside him. It was pitch dark and he could see nothing. He was in a forest. And the thing or person was going so quietly that he could hardly hear its footsteps. What he could hear was breathing. His invisible companion seemed to breathe on a very large scale, and Shasta got the impression that it was a very large creature. And he'd come to notice this breathing so gradually, they had no really idea how long it had been there. It was a horrible shock. It darted into his mind that he had heard long ago that there were giants in these northern countries. He bit his lip in terror, but now that he really had something to cry about, he stopped crying. The thing, unless it was a person, went on beside him so very quietly that Shasta began to hope that he'd only imagined it. But just as he was becoming quite sure of it, there suddenly came a deep, rich sigh out of the darkness beside him. That couldn't be imagination. Anyway, he felt the hot breath of that sigh on his chilly left hand. If the horse he'd been riding was any good, or if he had known how to get any good out of the horse, he would have risked everything on a breakaway and a wild gallop. But he knew he couldn't make that horse gallop, so he went on at a walking pace, and the unseen companion walked and breathed beside him. At last, he could bear it no longer. "Who are you?" he said, barely above a whisper. "One who has waited long for you to speak," said the thing. Its voice was not loud, but very large and deep. Are you a giant?" asked Shasta. "You might call me a giant," said the large voice, "but I am not like the creatures you call giants." "I can't see you at all," said Shasta, after staring very hard. Then, for an even terrible idea to come into his head, he almost in a scream said, "You're not something dead, are you? Oh, please do go away. What harm have I ever done to you? Oh, I'm the unluckiest person in the whole world." Once more, he felt the warm breath of the thing on his hand and face. "There," it said, "that is not the breath of a ghost. Tell me your sorrows." Shasta was a little reassured by the breath. So then he tells this part here about he's been on this long journey and all these bad things that happened to him in the journey. He says, so he told how he had never known his real father or mother, and he had been brought up sternly by this fisherman who beat him. And then he told the story of his escape and how they were chased by lions and forced to swim for their lives and of all their dangers in Tashban, this other country, and about his night among the tombs where he had to sleep in this graveyard and how the beasts howled at him out of the desert. And he told about the heat and thirst of the desert journey and how they were almost at their goal when another lion chased them and wounded his friend on this journey. He was going on these two horses with his friend. A lion came up behind him and actually scratched the back of his friend. And also how very long it was since he had anything to eat. "I do not call you unfortunate," said the large voice. "Don't you think it was bad luck to meet so many lions?" said Shasta. "There was only one lion," said the voice. "What on earth do you mean? I've just told you there were at least 2 lions the first night, and there was only one, but he was swift of foot. How do you know?" "I was the lion." And as Shasta gaped with open mouth and said nothing, the voice continued, "I was the lion who forced you to join with your friend. I was the cat who comforted you among the houses of the dead. I was the lion who drove the jackals from you as you slept.
I was the lion who gave the horses the new strength of fear for the last mile so that you could reach the king you were going to in time. And I was the lion you do not remember who pushed the boat in which you lay, a child near death, so that it came shore to shore where a man sat wakeful at night to receive you. Then it was you who wounded my friend. Yes, it was I. But what for? Child, said the voice. I'm telling you your story, not hers. I tell no one any story but his own. Who are you? Asked Shasta. Myself, said the voice, very deep and low so that the earth shook. And again, myself, said the loud and clear voice. And the third time, myself, whispered so softly you could hardly hear it. And yet seemed to come from all around you as if the leaves rustled with it. Shasta was no longer afraid that the voice belonged to something that would eat him, nor that it was the voice of a ghost, but a new and different sort of trembling came over him. Yet he was glad, too. The mist was turning from black to gray and from gray to white. This must have begun to happen some time ago, but while he had been talking to the thing, he had not been noticing anything else. Now the whiteness around him became a shining whiteness. His eyes began to blink. Something ahead, he heard birds singing. He knew the night was over at last. He could see the mane and the ears and the head of his horse quite clearly now. A golden light fell on them from the left. He thought it was the sun. He turned and saw, pacing beside him, taller than a horse, a lion. The horse did not seem to be afraid of it, or else it could not see it. It was from the lion that the light came. No one ever saw anything more terrible or more beautiful. Luckily, Shasta had lived all his life too far south in his country to have heard the tales that were whispered in this country about this dreadful Narnian demon that appeared in the form of a lion. And of course, he knew none of the true stories about Aslan, the great lion, the son of the emperor, the king above all high kings. But after one glance at the lion's face, he slipped out of the saddle and fell at his feet. He couldn't say anything, but then he didn't want to say anything. He knew he needn't say anything. The high king above all kings stooped towards him. Its mane and some strange and solemn perfume that hung about the mane was all around him. It touched his forehead with its tongue. He lifted his face and their eyes met. Then instantly the pale brightness of the mist and the fiery brightness of the lion rolled themselves together into a swirling glory and gathered themselves up and disappeared. He was alone with the horse on a grassy hillside under a blue sky, and there were birds singing. So as I read that story to my daughter, I've shared with you sometimes before about my journey in seminary when I went through a really difficult period of doubt. And it was in seminary when I started to go through this period of doubt where I'm not sure what I even believed about God anymore, and that would I even be a pastor someday. And as I began to experience all this crushing doubt in my life, I remember so many times praying, God, where are you? Where are you? I am struggling. My faith is crumbling. I don't even know what I believe anymore and how I can believe any of this about you. Where are you? And all I felt was silence. I felt nothing. And for me, it was about the darkest time in my life that I'd gone through, where everything I'd hoped and everything I dreamed about my future felt like it was just crumbling away. And as I sat there, I felt many times in tears, crying out to God, where are you? There was nothing. And as I read this section of this book, and when I got to the part when he says, there were two lions, and Aslan responds, there was one. And he says, well, how do you know? And he says, because it was me. And I just lost it. I started crying so hard in front of my daughter because I felt God just whisper to me, John, I was there. I was there the whole time as you walked through that journey. I was there. And I heard him say, as I looked back on all the things that had been a struggle in my life, and he kept saying to me, John, I was always there. I was always there. You know, maybe right now, Jesus is in the process of enlarging your frame. And if not, he will definitely soon be doing it. Will you lose your current frame to gain Jesus' greater one? Will you lose your current frame of Jesus to gain a greater one? Let's pray. Lord Jesus, we are confronted with these expectations that Mary and Martha had, God, and that were good expectations. I don't think any of us would call them things that weren't good. They were wonderful. but yet you didn't meet them. And I know today, Lord, there's many of us, I think, right now that are sitting in the pews thinking about the times where you didn't meet our expectations. And maybe right now we're sitting here thinking of the very thing we're going through, thinking, how did I get here? How did this happen to me? How in the world did this even occur? What have I done? And maybe there's silence. Maybe there's nothing. Maybe you feel like God's even actually against you. I pray today, Lord Jesus, that you would lift up our eyes and you would show us that despite our circumstances, despite how we feel, despite what I believe about myself or about the world around me or about what I'm going through or interpreting how everything that's happening to me, God, that I would put all of it aside, and today that you would give us yourself. Jesus, we don't need anything else. We need you. We need you. And I know some of us long for answers. We long for reasons why. But Lord, give us eyes of faith. Give us hearts of faith that say, Jesus, I don't know how I can, but I choose to believe in you. I choose to trust you. I choose to believe that you love me, that you care about me, that you're for me and not against me, that you're always with me, even if I don't feel you're with me, that you're fighting for my life, protecting my life, guarding my life, and you have a future for me, even if I cannot see it or understand it. Lord Jesus, continue to enlarge our frames. Make them bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger so that we might continue to know the God who is there, the God who loves us, and not the God we want to be there or we expect to be there. Lord Jesus, we ask you right now to meet us in our place, wherever each of us are at. I ask you to meet us there right now. We love you, Jesus, in your name. Amen.